Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence is a feature of this program, I'm proud to say, is that of Gordon Chang. He is, of course, one of our country's duty experts on China and related topics. You can find his writings these days at the Gatestone Institute and Newsweek, among other places. He is also the author of several important books, including The Coming Collapse of China and the Great U.S.-China Tech War. He is always a welcome guest here, and I encourage you to do as I do, which is follow him at Gordon G. Chang on Twitter. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Gordon, we're going to be talking a lot in the course of this program about the immense losses that American investors have suffered at the hands of the Chinese Communist Party in recent days. You've written about part of the story that the Chinese seem to be getting into a position to expropriate American investments in tech firms. But back the lens up a little bit and talk about more generally, what is Xi Jinping up to, and why does he think it's in China's interest to be costing those who have provided very substantial sums over the years to the Chinese through their companies to shatter the confidence in the those kinds of investments?
Xi Jinping demands absolute control over China. If it were up to him, he'd go back to a Maoist economy because he reveres Mao. And although he doesn't have the political power to do everything he wants, he nonetheless is pushing China very fast in that direction. And so for him, it doesn't matter whether people lose hundreds of billions of dollars or even trillions of dollars to China. What's more important is the primacy of the Communist Party. And that means wherever he feels that foreign investors and even domestic private entrepreneurs adversely affect that, he will go out and make changes that will surprise everyone. One other thing, Frank, and that is Wall Street and many others in America and around the world just look at Xi Jinping and say, oh, he can't really mean what he says. Well, yes, he does. He actually means it. And so, therefore, we're on notice about where he is driving China.
One of the things that Xi Jinping agreed to, Gordon, in the so-called Phase One deal with Donald Trump was to allow a number of large U.S.-based money managing firms to set up shop with wholly owned subsidiaries in China. How does his concern about control apply to them, do you think, if at all?
One thing is that China, even under Xi Jinping, will allow foreigners in areas where they think they need expertise, where they need money. And then when they feel they no longer need them, they then close the market to them. We know that the Trump administration pressed very hard on that at a time where China did need a trade deal with the United States. So they made a concession. But I think that they're going to renege on that, like they renege on every trade deal. And by the way, the heart of the Phase One trade deal of last January or January of last year was that China would purchase a certain amount of goods and services from the U.S. China is well behind on its commitments.
Well, again, no surprise there. But I just am wondering whether these firms, BlackRock and J.P. Morgan and Morgan Stanley and Goldman and the like, Vanguard, are actually going to be sort of cushioning the blow to U.S. investors arising from the kind of capriciousness that we've seen out of the Chinese Communist Party of late by virtue of being sort of embedded in the Chinese economy and therefore have every interest to continue doing business with them, even though, again, investor confidence has to be sorely tried.
Yeah, I don't think those institutions have the power to cushion the blow. And we have seen that, of course, last month where for a number of reasons, there's been losses. For instance, last week of July, there was a loss of almost $150 billion in value of U.S. listed Chinese stocks. One of the most important announcements was that Xi Jinping believed that there should be no profit-making companies in the tutorial sector. A lot of those companies were listed on the New York Exchange, and that really means that he has wiped out an entire industry. So I didn't see Morgan Stanley able to stop that. What Morgan Stanley and the others will be able to do is to continue to lobby the United States not to do anything effective against what China is doing. And that's where we're really in trouble. And by the way, on a more important point, just to look at all of this, we should not be fueling and servicing and enriching and funding a hostile regime that is attacking the United States. So there shouldn't be any American financial institutions inside of China. I think the President of the United States should be using persuasive power, plus also the power under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977 to make sure that these institutions do not set up in China. This was a mistake of the Trump administration to ever put this in the Phase One trade deal, and we should be pressing the United States to reverse this.
I couldn't agree more, Gordon Chang. This is especially true against the backdrop of something you've written about at Gatestone I mentioned a moment ago. Talk a little bit about the prospect that American investors are going to simply lose their shirts on tech firms in China.
The tech firm is off limits to foreign investment under Chinese law. Now, Americans do own shares in companies like Alibaba, Tencent, DD Global, but that's only because of a ruse. This is the variable interest entity structures that have been put in place. Americans don't buy shares of Alibaba or whatever. They buy shares or ADRs, American Depository Receipts, in offshore companies that sit atop what are known as variable interest entity structures. Those are a series of contractual arrangements which give the offshore company the economic benefits of the underlying Chinese company like Alibaba. Now, these are dubious from a legal point of view. There have been a number of rulings of the People's Supreme Court, the highest court in China, and there have been arbitration rulings in China as well on similar structures that have not survived legal scrutiny. Also, a lot of people say, well, China would never expropriate a company like Alibaba. Well, the point is that China's already done that. They did that in the 1990s with China Unicom, a telecom company. Telecom sector is off limits to foreign investment. Foreign investors put together what's known as the China-China foreign structure to get around those ownership restrictions, just like the variable interest entity structures get around the other restrictions on foreign investment. China came in and said, look, foreigners cannot own China Unicom shares in this structure, and they just took them away. So the same thing could happen, especially because Xi Jinping doesn't want the foreigners in the tech sector in the first place. We've seen that, of course, with all the things that he's done since November of last year.
Yes, we have. And yet Americans continue to plow money into that sector, as best I can tell. I think most of them, Gordon, unwitting. And we'll be talking more about that with Chris Iacovella and Bill Walton and the rest of this program. Let me turn to one other story that's perhaps a work in progress, just to get an update from you. I've been hearing about the possibility that the Saudis might make a deal very substantial deal with the Chinese for them to purchase large quantities of Saudi oil for years to come, with the requirement that the deal be transacted in renminbi, the Chinese currency, rather than petrodollars, as they've been called. What's your take on that deal? Is it still a gleam in the eye, or is it coming to pass?
Eventually, it could come to pass. The problem is that the renminbi requirement, the renminbi is not convertible on the capital account. And indeed, over the last two or three years, it's been more restricted rather than liberalized. And that really means that renminbi is really not that attractive to hold. I don't know what the Saudis are, where they're going to get their renminbi. and what they're going to do with the renminbi once they get it. Eventually, China could get a deal like this in place and running, but I don't think that they're there quite yet. The international usage of the renminbi is like 5%, and much of that is trade with countries that have robust economic relations with China. Saudi Arabia doesn't, apart from this deal. And so I think that this is going to be more mirage than reality, at least for a little while. Eventually, they may be able to get it going, but not in the immediate future.
Let me turn to something else that occurred recently that you've written about, Gordon. You described it as an ambush. It was sort of deja vu all over again, what the Deputy Secretary of State was treated to during her recent much ballyhooed visit to her Chinese counterparts. What actually went down there, and why is the government of China exhibiting such contempt for the Biden team?
Wendy Sherman, who is the Deputy Secretary of State, in other words, America's number two diplomat, went to the Chinese city of Tianjin on July 26th, last Monday, to speak to her counterpart, Wang Yi, the foreign minister, who's also the number two diplomat in China. What happened was an ambush, as I put it, and the reason is that the Chinese really were not interested in talking to her. They did use her visit to launch a propaganda campaign against the United States. They were clearly not concerned about dialogue. What they were concerned about is giving the impression to the Chinese people that China was now in a position to make demands to the U.S. and that the U.S. had really no other alternative but to comply. The number five in the foreign ministry, who is the number six in China's diplomat, gave Sherman two lists, essentially two lists of demands. And this is something that was similar to the mid-March meeting in Anchorage between Yang Jiechi and Wang Yi, number one and number two diplomats of China, when they met Secretary of State Antony Blinken and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan. There, again, the Chinese came to deliver lectures, and it was accompanied by pre-planned propaganda campaigns against the U.S. So really what we're seeing right now is a China that believes it can force the U.S. to do things, or at least it is not interested in any sort of meaningful conversation with America at this time.
There's another development on the diplomatic side, and that is the dispatch to the United States of Qin Gang. Have I got that pronunciation right? Gordon, the new ambassador from Beijing to our country. Wolf warrior, I think, is a term that has been applied to him in the past. Is that what we should expect here as well?
Qin Gang arrived in Washington. He is described as a wolf warrior. We really don't know what he's going to be doing because he's just the mouthpiece. And it really depends on the way Xi Jinping views things. But clearly right now, as we've seen from the Sherman visit, we're probably going to get some pretty hostile blasts from Qin. The initial statements he made were quite conciliatory when he arrived in Washington, but I don't believe that that's going to be their long-term posture towards the Biden administration.
We'll be, again, watching this too. And as you say, it's just a function of the regime in Beijing, and it seems to be pretty much full wolf warrior at the moment, at least. Qin Gang may have some moderating effect on it, we'll see, but my guess is it will be more of the same along the lines of what both Blinken and Sullivan and more recently Wendy Sherman received. Let me ask you finally, Gordon, about the outbreak of the Delta variant of the virus that the Chinese unleashed on the world, the CCP virus, I call it, the COVID-19. What is happening with respect to this outbreak and where in China at the moment?
The most recent outbreak started in Nanjing. Beijing is blaming a flight from Russia on July 20. It said that the Chinese cleaners of the plane were not following established protocol. And this disease or this variant from Nanjing has now reached about 13, 14 Chinese cities, including Beijing. And it's in about eight provinces, so it spread very fast. The problem for China is that although it does have draconian measures, which it imposes, and which they're imposing in this case, Nonetheless, they don't have a particularly effective vaccine. And without that, they're forced to these total lockdowns. We have seen, for instance, in Nanjing, that some people are being tested for the third time now, since July 20. They're testing the entire city of 9.3 million. They're doing this across China right now. And we have seen similar outbreaks, including the one in Guangzhou, which is the capital of Guangdong province. That's important because it shut down the Chinese ports for a little while. Beijing, although it says it has effectively controlled this disease, it's not in control at all as the Delta variant ravages China.
There's no evidence that the Delta virus has had anything to do with the Chinese biological weapons program, is there?
No evidence, but a lot of people suspect that. This was a topic of conversation in India when Delta was going through India at a rapid clip. The one thing, Frank, is that most viruses tend to become less transmissible and less virulent. Delta is exhibiting the opposite characteristics, and so it is a puzzle and a mystery. We're going to get to the bottom of this eventually. But right now, this is one very strange pathogen.
Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. So much more to talk with you about, but I appreciate this update as we do your visits with us each week. Thank you for joining us and for your expertise on so many topics that are really vital to our understanding of the challenge we face from China and the Chinese Communist Party specifically. God bless you, my friend. Come back to us again next week if you would. Next up, we'll speak with Chris Iacovella of the American Securities Association. We'll drill down more on what has happened in the Chinese market and what it might mean for you. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In recent days, U.S. investors have lost over $400 billion in funds invested, often without their knowledge, in non-transparent, unaccountable, and ultimately unreliable companies tied to the Chinese Communist Party. This financial carnage prompted 7 U.S. senators to write the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, raising serious concerns about such exposure and the fact that foreign shareholders have no claim against the PRC corporations in which they are supposedly invested. Instead, they typically hold paper issued by so-called variable interest entities based in the Cayman Islands, and have no recourse if the Chinese government opts capriciously to sanction or regulate such firms. If Americans can't be persuaded to avoid investing in CCP-tied companies because they often pose threats to our national security and/or human rights values, maybe the prospect of losing their shirts will do the trick. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and I couldn't be more pleased to have with us our next guest. He's a man I have been importuning to come on for some time. He's very busy and very much a leader in the battle space over Chinese investments and the inadvisability of our indexes, our exchange-traded funds, our mutual funds, pension funds, and the like, investing in Chinese Communist Party tied companies. His name is Chris Iacovella. He is the chief executive officer of the American Securities Association, a role that he has forged and played with great effect, I believe. Prior to that, he was the CEO of the Equity Dealers of America and has served on both the staff of the U.S. Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and for a time was seconded from the commission over to the Financial Services Committee in the House of Representatives. So he has a wealth of experience in and around the securities markets and is really one of our go-to guys on how to understand how the Chinese are playing us, garnering immense amounts of money and putting investors in this country at great risk. Chris Iacovella, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's so good to have you with us. We've had a little bit of a scene setter provided in our previous segment with Gordon Chang, but I'd like to get your take as a guy who works with the Wall Street community, or is trying to keep them honest, at least, at the American Securities Association. What has happened in the past couple of weeks, Chris, to this idea that you know, there's nothing but upside to investing in China, and we can't get enough of it and enough vehicles to put American investors' money into in China, you know, sort of bring it on.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, groups like yours and the Committee on Present Danger China and others that you have helped educate finally got the message across to those in Washington. And the message was China's been allowed to infiltrate our capital markets for way too long, and that needs to end. And what that led to was a bipartisan push that resulted in President Biden expanding a Trump administration policy to remove all stocks, bonds, and indexes that include Chinese military and technology companies like Huawei and AVIC, which make surveillance cameras for the slave camps that they run in the Shenzhen province, to remove them from our marketplace. And this caught everybody by surprise on Wall Street because of their globalist bent and the narrative of, well, we have to invest in China. China is the only way we're going to get more growth. When in reality, the United States market from 2010 until right now has gone up fivefold. So it's a pretty good investment to have your money here in the United States, but Wall Street did its best to create a false narrative. And interestingly, Frank, inside of that order, there was a provision that was squarely aimed at Wall Street and the Chinese Communist Party. It says, quote, any conspiracy formed to violate any prohibition in the order is prohibited. Now, you don't put something like that in there if you are not worried about the Chinese Communist Party hiring lobbyists, hiring Wall Street, colluding, and then trying to pressure the Securities Exchange Commission or the Biden administration to reverse this decision to keep these companies out of our market. And now you fast forward to today, and what you have is a situation where the Chinese Communist Party is trying to dump the last of its golden gooses into our marketplace. And after one of its companies came into our marketplace, 2 days after, to be exact, Didi, Xi decided, well, that's it. We got our IPO money. Now let's just crack down on this company. And it basically destroyed the company, took apps off of all of accessible outlets for Didi, which is a ride-hailing company that's similar to Uber, and it crushed the market cap of that company, and its shares went from $16.65 down to a low of $8 last week. Now, that is almost over 50% drop in market cap because of the actions of the Chinese Communist Party. So what that tells us, what that tells me, and what it should tell all of your listeners, is that the Chinese Communist Party owns Chinese companies, every single one of them. So that anybody who tells you that Chinese companies listed here on our exchanges who aren't associated with the military or state-owned enterprises are independent is wrong, because you have example after example after example of it, and Didi is just the latest one.
I'm just struck by what you've said there, that within 2 days of this IPO launching in Wall Street and making billions for this company, the Chinese government took this step. Did they wind up profiting, the Chinese Communist Party itself, from what they did to play us in that instance?
Well, Frank, you know, our view is that the Chinese Communist Party owns every single company in China, and it will take money from them as it sees fit, when it sees fit. And in this case, it saw fit to do that after $4 billion of Americans' money was raised on the U.S. stock exchanges here in the United States. And who bought into that? It wasn't you or me. We were retail investors. It was institutional funds. It was asset managers, mega asset managers. These people were taking your money as fiduciaries and putting it into a company that they couldn't even understand the regulatory risks, because China won't let you understand those risks. It will claim a security secret when you try to inquire about who exactly owns the company, what the financials are, who it does business with. All of it's a black box. So you're, and the, you know, I know that you want to get into this later, but This is not just a black box. It's a shell company. And investors who put money into these shell companies don't own anything. They have no legal recourse in the United States or in China to get their money back after it's taken or after a regulatory action is taken. So, you know.
Now, these are the so-called variable interest entities, VIEs. And as Gordon was suggesting, there's a serious problem with those entities because investors are essentially left holding the bag if something goes wrong. Is that right? And talk about that in the context of not just Didi, but some of these other entities that that we found ourselves in similar straits with. Alibaba comes to mind.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long list of them, Frank. There's Alibaba, there's the Ant Group, there's Didi, there's Tal Education, there's Luckin Coffee. The list goes on and on and on, and they're frauds. Most of these, but I'll just back up and give your readers, your listeners, just a little bit of focus on what we're talking about when we use this language VIE. Basically, what's happening here is you have a Chinese company that establishes an offshore shell company in the Cayman Islands. Then that company issues shares of its stock to U.S. investors by listing itself on either the NASDAQ or the New York Stock Exchange. And the important part here is the shell company has absolutely no equity ownership in the company in China. I'm going to say that again. The shell company is just that. It has no equity ownership in the China-based operating company. Okay? So U.S. investors own nothing.
And so when something goes wrong, whether it's a government intervention, as we've seen now in several of these instances, or turns out the company's just a fraud, you're losing your shirt, in other words, having invested in this. And why this is important, going back to what we were talking about a moment ago, Chris Iacovella, is that this is not confined to individual retail investors in the United States. Large numbers of us who happen to have money invested in one or the other of these large funds will find themselves with that kind of exposure and that kind of downside risk if the people who manage those funds have done what seven United States senators observed to the SEC chairman, Gary Gensler, last week, secured vast sums, billions of dollars, they said, in commissions for putting your money, perhaps without your knowledge, certainly that of a lot of other people's knowledge, into Chinese companies that are essentially, you know, shell companies, as you say, these VIEs. There's something really fundamentally wrong here. And those senators are saying to Gary Gensler, you know, you need to clean this up.
That's right, Frank. And you know, last week, they issued a warning saying, well, you know, you should receive disclosure that tells you that you're investing in a shell company and not in the operating company. And I mean, that's like telling folks, yeah, we're going to steal all your money, but we told you that we were going to do it, so you can't do anything to us. I mean, it's and this is why this issue that we're talking about is so important and why it's paramount to get these companies out of our markets, delisted, deregistered, and don't ever allow them to come in again, is because it matters for what people think about the integrity of our capital market. Do people trust our capital market? We want that to happen. And right now we're in a position where you're telling Americans and investors across the country that you're invested in a shell company that doesn't own anything, but we're still going to allow that to happen. That's the job of the regulator, to stop Ponzi schemes like that. That's what this is. It's being run at the highest levels of the Chinese Communist Party, and it's being aided and abetted by Wall Street. And what's amazing about this is that Wall Street will continue to lecture the United States investor and citizens in this country about environmental and social issues, but their virtue signaling stops when it comes to Chinese companies. It hasn't stopped doing business with the CCP. It still invests its portfolios in CCP-controlled companies. And I mean, you know, just the other day, we were looking at a global clean energy ETF, which is loaded with Chinese companies. Now, you tell me, how is it possible that these people could start to to push ESG and all these other reforms into the American investor portfolio when Chinese companies are in them. And those people are committing unspeakable atrocities from a human rights perspective and building, you know, multiple coal-fired power plants. So, you know, this whole thing from Wall Street's perspective has been a scam that's been run on the American investor.
And this is why you've taken, it seems to me, a very robust position on all of these Chinese companies. This will doubtless be shocking to those on Wall Street and probably in the investment community. But when you point out, Chris, as you have here, that there's no getting around it. You're dealing with the Chinese Communist Party, and that is our mortal enemy. And if you add on top of it, Chris, these so-called A-shares, you have even further compromising of our national interests, our national security interests, our human rights values, among other things. Talk a little bit about these A-shares. How do they work, and what kind of connivance do we see on Wall Street's part, and the regulators for that matter, in having them have access to our capital markets as well?
Well, they're getting access to our capital markets through the back door. They are using what I call a passive index loophole, where Wall Street aids and abets the Chinese Communist Party to get companies that aren't even listed in the United States, that are listed in the Shenzhen, Shanghai, and other exchanges in Hong Kong, and they package these companies up into an index, and then they put that index into our markets by having an asset manager like BlackRock or Vanguard or State Street issue it to the American investor as an ETF, and then selling it with disclosure saying, well, you know, their regulatory regime is a little bit different than ours, and so you have to know that. But at the end of the day, there's no recourse there either. And we've asked the SEC to check into what kind of fiduciary obligation these ETF issuers have as it relates to doing diligence on A-share companies or on any index, which includes Chinese companies, whether they're listed in the United States or not. Because that is this is a complete and total exploitation of our capital markets. It's being perpetrated by Wall Street, and it needs to stop because our stock market is the envy of the world. And the CCP is using it to fund policies that undermine American values, from military to human rights to the environment.
And in the process, introducing undisclosed risk to investors as well. It's a lose-lose proposition, it seems to me. Chris, lastly, let me just ask you something I talked about briefly with Gordon. This phase one trade deal that President Trump secured back in January of last year didn't work out terribly well, I think, across the board. But one piece of it is worrying to me particularly, and that is the opening that it created for BlackRock and other big U.S. money managers to go into China and do deals with wholly owned subsidiaries there. How does that tie into what you were just talking about in terms of migrating these A shares through the sort of a back door or otherwise, you know, avoiding U.S. regulation and aiding and abetting the Chinese Communist Party in the process?
Well, I think, you know, we take a holistic view of this, Frank. What has happened is that Xi has decided to crack down on every industry that China doesn't need anymore. Okay, they took our technology. They don't need technology companies in their country anymore. They're cracking down on any manufacturing companies, defense companies. The only one that they still need to figure out how to emulate our processes is Wall Street. And Wall Street is more than happy to go there. But what I'll tell you is that the crackdown post this DD stock confiscation of money by the CCP marks the end of Wall Street's false China narrative. Because now Wall Street must accept that the CCP is what it is, which is an authoritarian regime that commits human rights atrocities and destroys our environment. And now it's up to shareholders who own shares in companies doing business in China to ask CEOs, to ask management, what are you doing? Why are you doing business with these people? And to hold them out for what they are, for the doing business with these kind of this regime, you know, which some have called, and I think there was others who called it a transnational criminal organization. So, you know, what we're talking about here is just, it's common sense to most people, but it takes a while for that to sink in here in Washington.
Well, and on Wall Street, too, as you know very well from your vantage point as the head of a outfit that does represent the non-Wall Street financial community, I think, admirably. And you run into these guys and their games all the time and call them on it, Chris Iacovella, with great clarity. And I think with great authority, and it's terrific that you do so, and we appreciate you doing it here from time to time and look forward to having you back soon. Thanks for today's messages, as they're vitally important and couldn't be more timely against the backdrop of the losses that American investors have just sustained in China. I hope it is indeed the end of the false China narrative on Wall Street, as you suggested, Chris, and we look forward to working with you to make that so. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Talk to you soon. Next up, we'll speak with Bill Walton, get a former insider's view from Wall Street on all that we've just been talking about and what it means for you, most especially. That and more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and joined by another of our regulars, I'm pleased to say, here at Secure Freedom Radio, Bill Walton. He is the host of The Bill Walton Show, a terrific TV podcast. He is also a former Master of the Universe on Wall Street and now has a new project. He calls it the Resolute Protector Foundation, a 501c3, of which he is the president. He is one of our duty experts on matters involving high finance and public policy, and we appreciate his leadership in the conservative movement, notably with the Council for National Policy, of which I'm very pleased to be a member, and always appreciate a chance to visit with him. Bill, it's good to have you back. Thank you for joining us.
Frank, thanks for having me back.
Well, the program has really led up marvelously to this conversation with you, with Gordon Chang sort of giving us a geostrategic overview of what has operated that has resulted in hundreds of billions of dollars being lost in China by American investors in recent weeks. And Chris Iacovella explaining about some of the mechanics of how this has happened to us and the fact that it is not an altogether new phenomenon. We got into this mess with a number of steps that have been taken, notably going back to 2013 when then Vice President Joe Biden helped engineer a memorandum of understanding that essentially gave the Chinese preferential access to our markets. They didn't have to conform to our accounting rules and so on. I wanted to get your view, Bill, as a former Wall Street insider, of how the guys that you used to run with are likely to view all of this. Is it going to prompt them, do you think, to stop doing what they've done so much of in recent years, particularly since 2013, namely investing other people's money in non-transparent, non-accountable, and in some cases outright fraudulent Chinese companies controlled by the Chinese Communist Party?
Well, the Wall Street's going to play by the rules that are promulgated by the SEC. And you know, to back up a bit, you know, you mentioned 2013 in the Memorandum of Understanding. I mean, Wall Street has been given a playbook by the regulators and by Washington that they're supposed to do business with China, regardless, because China was one of the preferred entities. And we did it all for pretty good reasons. We're trying to bring China into the global economy, the global liberal democratic community. And of course, we now know that was a serious miscalculation and didn't recognize the fact that somebody like Chairman Xi would emerge and really begin cracking down on China, China's economy, Chinese people, and bringing it back into line, old school Chinese Communist Party style. So Wall Street is looking at this and, you know, there's an index, the MSCI China Index, that shows what's happened with Chinese stocks in the last 10, 15 years. And it's been on a tear since 2008 and peaked at an all-time high in February of this year. And then as Xi and the regulatory regime in China began cracking down on Chinese tech companies, education companies, you know, the long list of companies they want to bring under tighter state control, Wall Street's reacted by, you know, driving the share price down of these companies and the indexes, and the indexes is off 20-25%, and even Goldman Sachs, our friends who have been probably the most important driver of what's going on in China on Wall Street, even now they're saying they're expecting another 20% correction by the end of the year. And they're also having conversations with their clients, and their clients are beginning to say, has China become uninvestable? And if you tie that back into Gordon Chang's theory, and Gordon obviously is the subject matter expert on this, I don't want to wander too far into his expertise, but if Gordon's right, and this VIE structure is being used to unravel non-Chinese ability to invest in Chinese companies, then China does become uninvestable. And Wall Street's going to react in that way. The thing we have to keep in mind is the world equity market now, I don't know exactly where it is with stocks reaching new highs, is a $75 trillion market. And while the U.S. is probably 40% of that, a combination of New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ, you still have significant exchanges in Shanghai and Shenzhen and Tokyo. And, you know, they've got $4-5 trillion market caps each in those. And so Xi, I think, is calculating as he engages in this crackdown that he may not need the U.S. capital markets to finance Chinese businesses. And he clearly has an agenda here that's non-economic. He wants control. Now but Wall Street does soft pedal this stuff. I mean, they still want to be friends with China. They still think it's going to become investable again. And you know, in the Goldman Sachs reports that are coming out now, they're saying, let me do this in the euphemistic way they're saying it. Recent regulations have signaled that the Chinese authorities are prioritizing social fairness and stability over the capital markets. I mean, well, that's certainly a euphemism. That
big time.
World's up.
Well, one could call it misleading, not just a euphemism. It's about control. But, you know, you're absolutely right.
They want to stay viable. You know, they've got a lot of Chinese nationals working for all these big Wall Street firms. It's not. They truly are global enterprises. They're not really American.
That's how they think of themselves. That's for sure. Yeah. Witness their seeming indifference to national security implications of all of this, let alone, you know, human rights values and the like. But let me bring you to the point that you were sort of touching on there a moment ago. Whether Wall Street thinks China still is investable or not, their clients may well have reached the point where they say, you know, it isn't, and we don't want to be continuing to risk our net worth in these kinds of schemes that can result in vast losses completely capriciously, as with, you know, Didi and Alibaba and Ant Capital and so on. When you look at the consumer, let me just ask you, Bill, when you look at the consumer and their willingness to accept these kinds of losses, especially as I suspect a lot of them are surprised that they are even in China, let alone that they're at risk as they are, because, you know, the investment managers have been putting their money through exchange-traded funds and so on into China.
Only if they stop putting investment dollars into these entities. But I would have advised people not to go into Chinese stocks 5 years ago, 10 years ago. I mean, you look at the structure, this VIE structure, clearly intended to circumvent the Chinese intention, which is they don't want foreign investors. And you've got no voting rights, you've got a minority position, you have what they call a quote, economic interest, which means you participate in the upside so long as they let you. But there's been cases where I think there was a banking company that used this structure, and they had some investors in it, and the banking company shares went up 600 times from where they were. They made a fortune. And the Chinese Communist Party simply decided, well, you don't own that. And so they lost their entire investment because of the capricious control of the authorities in China. To put your real money into China as an American is nuts. It just makes no sense whatsoever. And Wall Street will stop providing these investment products if people wake up to the fact that they're going to, the risk of losing all their money is pretty high.
Well, let's hope that message is being,
Wall Street's behavior.
Yeah, let's hope that message is now being conveyed. One of the things that I'm particularly concerned about, Bill, is that, you know, a lot of American investors don't know that their money is going into China and into particularly these kinds of really problematic entities. And to say nothing of the fact that all of these Chinese companies are, as Chris Cavella pointed out, controlled and effectively owned by the Chinese Communist Party. One of the things that I'm very keen on, as you know, is a project of our friend Kevin Freeman called the National Security Investment Consultants Institute, which is designed to train financial managers into how best to invest their clients' money patriotically, if that is in fact the value that most investors seem to have. And to counteract this somewhat surreptitious, I think it's fair to say, sluicing of their funds into China, which is not consistent with their values, and it turns out probably their equities as well. Bill, let me just ask you about one last thing. We've talked off air about an insight from our friend Victor David Hansen about getting clear what we're dealing with in China and how capable we are of meeting the threat that increasingly is emerging from that quarter, both economic, of course, but also of old-fashioned kinetic military kinds as well.
Well, China, Victor David Hansen's, you know, one of our best historians and thinkers, and has moved from history into modern life and trends and a penetrating analysis. And he wrote a piece recently entitled China's Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere. Quite a mouthful. But nevertheless, it's extremely interesting because he says China's not inevitable. If you look at their demographics, because of the one-child policy, it's an aging population. Its productivity compared to the United States is like one third if you measure our output per person versus what China does. China really has no allies in the world. They're surrounded by countries that are hostile to it, with maybe the exception of North Korea, but I'm not so sure North Korea matters in the larger scheme of things. And so they've got a lot of, and then it's also, as we're seeing, increasingly insular and unwilling to take innovation, either from markets or from people who are from countries that are outside China. So their insularity is a problem. And what Xi is doing now will definitely, by cracking down on private sector companies, will definitely hurt its growth rate. They've got a huge overhang of debt. And he goes on to say, well, you know, that we really need to be clear that they're not inevitable. But then he concludes, his last paragraph is also a little disheartening because he says all that's going to be required of us is a returned financial solvency, renewed national unity, appreciation of American singularity, and an end to politicization of the U.S. officer corps. Now, you and I have talked about these trends. I mean, return to financial stability. We're running, you know, we're spending, federal government spending $6 trillion a year. They're taking in $3 trillion a year in taxes. We've had a deficit the last couple of years of $3 trillion. Our debt as a percentage of GDP is now probably 120-130%. And that's not including all the entitlements, which brings it up to, you know, 200-300% of GDP. Most people, including me, who know study economics, would call that stall speed. You have that kind of debt overhang and budget deficit overhang. It's extremely debilitating. Our military budget would be overwhelmed if interest rates went up 300-400 basis points.
That seems in prospect. Needless to say, but Bill, we don't have time to get into the other three conditions that Victor has mentioned, but those don't seem terribly promising either. So it underscores the importance that we've attached in this program. And I think in our work together with you and others day in and day out, and that is we have got to come to grips with this China threat and to understand it for what it is and to deal effectively with it, or we are toast, I fear, and that's not a happy prospect. Bill, we have to leave it at that.
One point to make, though, is if we shine a proper light on what China's doing, it might make us more serious about solving these other problems.
Amen. And it's certainly what we're all about here. Bill, thank you for joining us. Come back to us again next week, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In recent days, U.S. investors have lost over $400 billion in funds invested, often without their knowledge, in non-transparent, unaccountable, and ultimately unreliable companies tied to the Chinese Communist Party. This financial carnage prompted seven U.S. senators to write the chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission, raising serious concerns about such exposure and the fact that foreign shareholders have no claim against the PRC corporations in which they are supposedly invested. Instead, they typically hold paper issued by so-called variable interest entities based in the Cayman Islands, and have no recourse if the Chinese government opts capriciously to sanction or regulate such firms. If Americans can't be persuaded to avoid investing in CCP-tied companies because they often pose threats to our national security and/or human rights values, maybe the prospect of losing their shirts will do the trick. This is Frank Gaffney. This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.